Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today, I have a guest author whom I met through a previous guest author interview. And I always say a referred guest is always the best kind. He is Dave Butler. Since he was 8 years old, Dave wanted to write like Tolkien, but he got a bit distracted by life. It took college, law school, 11 years of legal practice, and getting fired to get his head back in the game. Dave writes speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy, superhero, horror, and cyberpunk for readers of all ages. Wordfire Press publishes his steampunk novel, City of the Saints, as well as his series, Rock Band Fights Evil and the Booza System. Dave is also Wordfire's acquisitions editor and travels regularly with Wordfire to Comic-Con style events all around the United States. Dave's big press debut is The Kidnap Plot, and we will find out more about that in a moment. Dave lives in Utah with his wife Emily and three children. Emily is also a novelist whose debut will be Freya and Zeus. And Dave is a corporate trainer and a business acumen consultant by day. He plays guitar and loves way too many languages. And I'm interested to learn more and share them with you. So welcome to the show, Dave.
Hey, thanks, Pat. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you as well. Now, your website is titled, well, the website address is davidjohnbutler.com and is titled Dave Butler Writes. Then you have the word smart, period, action, period, fantasy, period. And I was wondering, why did you choose those three words, and why a period after each one?
Yeah, well, I've never been asked that question before. That's fantastic, Pat. So my background, as you've already said, of course, is in business and law. So even as a lawyer, I was a securities lawyer. So clients were either companies looking to raise capital by selling shares or by borrowing, or they were clients of money banks. Assisting such companies. So I'm a big advocate for writers thinking about themselves as businesses, and aspiring or early stage writers thinking of themselves as startup businesses. And one thing that every business, a successful business, has is an idea of what its brand is. And so I actually thought of those three words as a way to focus my brand. What do I write? Well, you know, if it doesn't have some element of the fantastic, I'm probably not interested in writing it. If it's not an action story, I'm not interested in writing it. And if there's not something clever or different or smart, then I'm not interested in writing it either. So that's my brand statement. And then I put it up on my website to remind really me. And you're the first person to ask me about it.
Well, what does that say about me?
That you're perceptive, that you're paying attention. Well done.
Oh, well done to you, too, because I think that's interesting that you actually thought about the brand and the marketing and the business side of it as you were building that website. And I think so many people are more focused so much on the book that the whole marketing piece goes to the wayside. But I'm sure we're going to talk a little more about marketing later on. So why speculative fiction? Or maybe, let's stop for a minute, define that first, and then tell us why you like that genre.
Speculative fiction is a very broad term, and it's meant to encompass everything that is science fiction or fantasy or something like those genres. So it has some sort of twist distinguishing it from reality. There are superheroes, there are vampires, there are monsters, there are wizards. We are in space and use ray guns. It's easy, in fact, with the proliferation of self-publishing technology, it's easier than ever to split up into micro genres where you say, well, I'm not steampunk because I have fossil fuel-powered engines, so I'm diesel punk. Or I have electricity, so I'm Tesla punk. And speculative fiction is a way of capturing all of those things under one tent, you know, without quibbling, without denying the distinction between space opera and science fiction, but also without trying to split that difference.
Interesting. There are so many genres that, like you say, these little micro genres that make it easier than ever to find that niche that makes sense to you. So why did this make sense to you? Why did you decide on this genre?
Well, because I want to write in a lot of them, because I don't want to pin down to any of them. The book that I initially picked up an agent with was a ghost story for young readers about a girl who was set in Victorian London, and the girl who was murdered along with her family and who returns as a ghost, and her family does not. And her unsettled business is to find and stop her murderer, right? And she fights evil. She becomes a sort of detective, sort of a superhero. Really, it's not a superhero-like setting such as we're used to, but it is a very classic superhero paradigm. And I've written epic fantasy, and I've written horror, and I've written steampunk. And so by speculative fiction, I want to catch them all under an umbrella. Mm-hmm. I have written realistic fiction, but very, very little. I'm trying to think if I've written anything in my adult life. And I think the answer might be no, mm-hmm. other than songs. I do write songs, but I think I'm pretty much a straight 100% fantasy, sci-fi, and stuff like those genres.
Mm-hmm. You write books for children and you write books for older readers. Tell us about that demographic and why you write for those age groups.
That's a good question. You know, there are probably good business reasons to do so, but that's actually not my thinking. I just, stories, I want to reach all readers, and sometimes you think of a story or a setting or a character, and it's clear that it's a children's story. And sometimes you think of a setting or a character or a plot or an idea, and it's clear that it can't be a children's story. And I don't want to limit myself to any of those.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure having children helps you to be a little inclined toward that. And how do your children feel about your children's stories?
They hear them. I think they like them. They give me comments. They're very good at catching when there are repetitive word choices, for example, or telling me, oh, this is the best part, or this is funny, or that part didn't quite work. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of fun. I think they've also figured out some of the rhythms of the business, and they like being able to read books before they're released
Ooh.
Public. Whether they're mine or sometimes I get ARCs or kind of beta reader copies with some books. And they enjoy that feeling of kind of being a little bit inside the story making machine.
Interesting. So between your wife who is a novelist and your children who are the beta readers, you've got a whole working group there, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's out of the living house.
So now how many books have you written?
Oh gosh, it depends what you count. Let's think about ones that are published and or imminently to be published. So what's up with Wordfire right now is a 7-book series called Rap Band Fights Evil. There are more of those coming, but there are 7 written. The Boozer System will be a trilogy, but there are basically 2 out now, or 1 and 1 imminent, and City of the Saints is a standalone. So that's 10 novels or novellas out now. The Kidnap Plot is coming out in 3.5 weeks, and I've already written 2 sequels, which will be out next year and the year after. I've got a deal with Bayon to publish my epic fantasy, so that first of those is coming out next year. So if you just count books that are already contracted and written and published, then I'm standing on about 14 right now.
Wow, you are a very prolific writer.
Well, I am when I can write full time. Mm-hmm. You know, the rhythms of my career have now been steady. I had an initial period of really high productivity while I wrote full time, and then I had a career change and came back to work. And I still write, but not nearly as consistently. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to get back to that full time model as soon as I can.
Great, great. And you mentioned this on June 14th, 2016, that's this year, your book, The Kidnap Plot, The Extraordinary Journeys of Clockwork Charlie, is going to make your big press debut. And I think that's so exciting, and I know you must be excited. Tell us about that.
I am very excited. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to say about it. But to start with, this is a book for readers of all ages. So it's formally, it's a middle reader book, so it's ages sort of 9 to 15. But the hope is that I've told a kind of story and a story using the kinds of language that would appeal to older readers too. You know, I remember riding the train into London to work at the law firm and seeing umpteen copies of Harry Potter in the hands of investment bankers and accountants. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I've written a story that appeals that broadly. That was certainly the goal. This is a story that is set not quite in our world. It is set in London in 1887, but it's a London that has trolls and pixies and kobolds and dwarfs, and it's a London that has fantastic steam-powered technology. So it is a fantasy story. It's a steampunk story. And in that world, Charlie is a boy who lives with his father in sort of a crummy neighborhood of London in Whitechapel. And his father is an inventor and a tinkerer. He has a clockwork invention and repair shop. And his father doesn't let Charlie leave the house, or very rarely lets him out the alley and behind the house to go just take the laundry to the launderer next door. And Charlie reads and yearns to have adventures and can't. He's under his father's thumb until his father is kidnapped. And so it's the story of Charlie having his chance to be an adventurer, having his chance to see this boy who's been raised on books, the voracious consumer of books, to go match that knowledge against experience, against the real world, and in an effort to go rescue his father. And along the way, of course, he learns dark secrets about his father and ultimately about himself. And it's the beginning of a series. The first is The Kidnap Plot. The second is called The Giant's Seat. Should be out a year later. And I'm working on finishing up The Library Machine, which is book three right now.
Oh, my. Dave, where does this come from? Like, where do you pull these thoughts to think, oh, I'm going to write about this? Or does the character lead you? How does that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in my experience, I usually get one thing for free, and that might be an idea of a character or an idea of a setting or sort of a what-if question. So just to rewind to an earlier story, so I'm not going to tell you what the one thing is I got for the kidnap plot because that would amount to a spoiler. But I'll give you another example. The first book that I picked up an agent with, the idea I had, I can't remember if I had just seen a Sherlock Holmes film or I was rereading Conan Doyle maybe, and I thought, what if Sherlock Holmes were just a front? And that's been done before. The movie Without a Clue with Ben Kingsley as Watson and Michael Caine as Holmes has Watson as the real crime fighter. He wants to be Watson's crime-fighting doctor, but everyone wants Sherlock Holmes, and so he's hired this actor who is a buffoon to play Holmes. But I thought, what if the real genius behind Holmes were the ghost of a little girl, like a really smart, very arrogant, condescending, just sharp-witted girl. And so that was it. That was the initial concept. And from there, it's a combination of craft, knowing what the pieces are that need to surround the one thing you get for free. Right? Okay, I've got a character. Mm-hmm. Well, I need a setting. What's the setting that makes this character work? What kinds of stories, what kind of things can this character try to accomplish? What kinds of villains or obstacles will be in her way, right? So craft is sort of a tool that lets you move forward, and as you move forward, the other thing that happens is more bits of inspiration come to you. You know, if you're properly feeding your muse, then the active work will produce more great ideas, and hopefully enough, and hopefully your craft lets you shape them into sufficiently correct, integral package that you end up with a great book.
Wow. What a fascinating process, huh?
Yeah. Fascinating, yeah. Fun, hard, intimidating, but I love it.
Well, now, with all of that going on, how do you know when your books are done?
That is a good question. I think, there are a lot of temptations for writers. One of them is to constantly re-edit. And so I think there's a diminishing, you think this is the law of diminishing returns, mm-hmm. or the 80-20 rule, right? There's 20% of the work, 80% of the goodness. But there is no perfect book. You pick up published books and you will find errors in them, right? It just happens. Mm-hmm. So you have to, at a certain point, say, well, that's it. That's enough. I'm done. I think, again, craft tells you when you've got all the right pieces. Craft, and especially your sort of language skills, tell you when, should tell you when the prose is correct, is properly nailed into place and planked. But at the end of the day, you have to have a kind of internal compass that says, well, this is good. I'm going to send this to my agent. I'm going to send this to my editor. I'm going to upload it into Amazon CreateSpace. I'm going to, give it to my beta readers, whatever it is. And that can be a terrifying moment.
Yes.
And if you go back and look at books you published 5 years ago, you will find mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and things where you say, well, I would do it different now. But that's just the way it is. You can't spend your life re-editing your first novel.
Now, you've written so many books. Do you have a favorite?
It's always the
one you're working on.
The one I'm working on now. Yeah. No, actually, I'm really excited about the Kidnap Plot. I really am. This is, I have loved. There are a lot of reasons to be excited about it. This is a story that will actually be in Barnes and Noble, which is a first for me.
Mm-hmm.
This is a book I've been on for a long time. The self-published, the indie published, editorial graphic. This has been a, three turns and then a line edit and then a galley. So it's been the full thing. And I love the cover art. Ken Paxton, that is absolutely fantastic. And he's been illustrating other people's sort of especially picture books.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got his own children's books that are coming out this fall. So that's been a great experience, and it's very exciting. And I think this is probably my widest audience book.
Okay.
Is another reason I'm excited. Mm-hmm. You write for, let's say, by contrast, Rock Band Fights Evil is a little bit edgy. It's about a rock and roll band that sells their souls and then wants to steal them back. So, it's not if my kids have not read those. And that's okay. It just means that I'm writing for a certain audience. Kidnap Plot and its sequels are books that that anybody can read. And I love Charlie. He's a wonderful character. He has a kind of naivete about him and a way he confronts the world where he is open hearted and sort of ready for the world to be wonderful even though it isn't. And so that's been a lot of fun.
As you were talking, I was just thinking about this. You're writing three books, and your character is Charlie. When you're all done with these three, you're going to miss him.
I will, although I'm hoping. If we still have a book one here, I'm hoping that I'll get to write more like five or six books.
Oh, okay. All right.
So we'll see. But yeah, I will. I will.
He's part of your day.
But this is a story about growing up, and so hopefully we can sort of bring this to a good cycle where at the end, Charlie's not the same person anymore.
Okay.
Charlie will be someone who has confronted the evil and confronted the evil of the world and also the evil within, and he's grown up and he's lost some of the naivete and hopefully transformed that kind of innocence into a more durable and sort of harder goodness. And I think that will, even though I'll miss him, I think his adventures will be done. Right? Then Charlie's ready to go out and do other things.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking forward to that. It's coming out June 14th, folks. The Kidnap Plot, The Extraordinary Journeys of Clockwork Charlie. That's exciting for you. All right, a couple of quick questions on your process. And so I'm sure everyone wants to know, pen and paper, pencil, computer, laptop, or crayons?
That's an excellent question. I have every single thing I have written, every single story I've written all in my life. I think in my life, because, you know, I am young enough that we had a computer in my house from when I was about 13. So I think every piece of complete fiction I've ever written that wasn't a song lyric or a poem, I wrote on a word processor.
Okay. All right.
That's interesting.
Yep.
I know others do it differently. You know, I was talking to Christopher Paolini, who's become kind of a friend of mine, the guy who wrote Aragon. And he wrote the fourth book in that series, or wrote most of it, using a dip pen.
Interesting.
Which, I'm not sure I have the fortitude to do that. I feel like if I were trying to write with a fancy pen, and I do have a fancy pen. I have a fancy pen for two purposes. It finds books.
Mm-hmm.
It finds publishing contracts. And I love my fancy pen. But I think if I wrote a whole book with it, I'd be so distracted by the experience of writing with a fancy pen.
Yes.
That it wouldn't be a very good book.
No, I get that. I would think the ideas would be rushing too quickly, and here you are dipping away and forgetting what you're thinking. All right, here's another very important question. Favorite munchy snack or drink while writing?
Well, so this is kind of disgusting, but I drink an awful lot of Diet Mountain Dew.
Oh, no, nobody heard that.
Yeah, and it's still very kind of, I don't know, low class, but that's okay. That's
no, I'm just saying healthy.
it's not healthy. Although it's probably, I don't know, maybe it's a case of pick your poison, but when I was younger, I would have been a non-diet Mountain Dew, but my metabolism won't really permit that anymore. I'm looking at a 46-ounce, nearly full cup of Diet Mountain Dew across the room right now.
Right now. Well, I appreciate your candor. How's that? You could have said something pretty...
That's very kind, yeah.
Exactly.
Like ranch dressing on carrots.
Yes.
I have to have that or I can't write.
And nobody would have believed you then. All right. What about panster or plotster?
I'm actually somewhere in between. I think most writers probably are. So if I sit down to write a story, there have been exceptions, but basically I have the first 20% to maybe a third of the story pretty plotted out. Plot points, subplot points, all the beats are there. And then for the remainder of the story, I kind of know at regular intervals where the main beats are. And I know roughly how the subplots have to go. And so the adventure of writing the book is the act of saying, well, it's almost like weaving, or at least it's what I imagine weaving is like, because I've never really woven anything more complex than a Boy Scout basket. But, I have these strands, and having woven the first bit pretty tightly, then it's an act of, okay, you know, let's keep weaving, and I've got that target just ahead of me, and I got to make sure not to forget this subplot. Okay, hit that target. Now let's keep weaving.
Right.
And as I'm writing, I'm also extending the outline just a couple of chapters ahead of me. It's almost like running into, I'm going to change metaphors. This is bad practice. I'm going to change metaphors anyway. It's like I have a short-range flashlight, and I'm running down a tunnel. So I can just see the ground just ahead of me.
I get it.
And I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I know where I'm going, and it's straight. Right in front of me, all I can see is just like 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the ending with always some small kind of variation. I land on that ending, and yet there is a lot of improvisation in between. I know writers who are, my friend Larry Correa is an accountant by trade, and he uses a very complex spreadsheet to plot everything. And I'm not that guy. I'm also not the guy who starts with just kind of like, well, here's the character. Let me, you know, Jill was walking down the road with a severed head under her arm and her lunch bag in her hand. I mean, and then we'll see what happens.
Right.
I think you can be successful doing that, but you have to be really good at editing, mm-hmm. or you have to have just an incredibly strong intuitive sense of the structure of story and the kinds of things that need to happen mm-hmm. when they need to happen in your tale.
Right. Very interesting, the thought about the accountant who has to have the spreadsheet. I'm wondering, I do a lot with personality style awareness and Myers-Briggs. I'm wondering if personality style really does transfer, say, to an author's writing style. It's something to think about.
That's interesting. So I believe I'm an INTJ.
Okay.
I've taken the test twice. It was at about, probably about 10-year intervals. And I got INTJ both times. So what do you think that should tell me, right, for which I should be playing? That's like the mastermind that is supposed to be. Maybe that would suggest I should be plotting more.
Interesting. I'm going to have to think about this.
There's like a book here you could write.
Absolutely. Better get busy, right?
Yeah.
All right. Now, you are also the acquisitions editor for WordFire. What is WordFire and what do you do there?
That is a great question. WordFire is a publishing company. It started, I'm going to say, about 5-6 years ago. Kevin J. Anderson and Rebecca Mesta own WordFire. They are married, and they've co-written some books. But so WordFire, a lot of writers have a corporate entity to do their business through. And this was a corporate entity to pursue their business. And about, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, so one of the things, he met another name, but they both write science fiction and fantasy. And Kevin has been, together with Brian Herbert, have written all of the expanded universe of Dune novels. So Frank Herbert wrote the original Dune, which is a top 10 science fiction books ever written. Like,
right.
You've got to read Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And he also wrote 5 sequels, and then he died. And his son Brian and Kevin wrote another, well, I don't know, like 14 or 15 books. And about 5-6 years ago, the Herbert family asked Kevin if he could take some of Frank's back catalog that was not in print and shop it to publishers. And Kevin did this, and he got such small offers, said, I'm pretty sure we'd get more money than this if we just put covers on them, put them up on Amazon ourselves, sold them that way. And that was so successful, he started then publishing his own back catalog and other back catalog the same way. And then at a certain point, he started picking up new writers. Mm-hmm. So WordFire is on the one hand, it is a publishing company. It publishes almost entirely speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy, steampunk, horror, superhero, all that stuff. There are a couple of exceptions. The most notable one is that we also publish a series of books about writing called The Million Dollar Guide, like The Million Dollar Guide to World Building, The Million Dollar Guide to the Creativity, or to, to professionalism, to productivity. There's about a half a dozen. So it's a publishing company, and it is a, it is aggressively growing. It's not really fair to call it small at this point. It is a mid-sized publishing company that really takes advantage of the changing ground in the way stories are distributed to readers.
Okay.
So a bookstore, a Barnes & Noble, or what have you, could call and order our books from Ingram or Baker and Taylor. Mostly they don't, though. Mostly we're not in bookstores. So how do we get books to readers? Well, we do it online through internet platforms. We do it through sort of unique, unusual distributing models, like we're in a lot of book bundles, for example. And then the other thing we do is we go to a lot of conventions. Now, the Comic-Con scene in America is blowing up. Mm. And we're not the only traveling publisher/bookstore in the scene, but WordFire is the premier. We are on the road all the time. And when there are other bookstores, we are the big one.
Okay.
We have the most books. We have the biggest names. We have a 3-story tall banner. So I said said, you know, one, Wordfire is a publisher, but two, Wordfire is also this, it's a bookstore. And when it travels in a bookstore, it sells Wordfire titles, but it also brings in guest authors who are not necessarily published by Wordfire, who will carry their books and will sell them to Comic-Con attendees. So I was, this last weekend, I just got back last night, I was in Kansas City for Planet Comic-Con. And we had several guests, but the biggest name one was Jim Butcher. So Jim Butcher was in our booth, and he came all 3 days and sat and signed, and we sold a ton of Jim Butcher's books, along with books by me, Dave Butler, by Quincy Allen, by Aaron Michael Ritchie, by Ramon Terrell, by Rhiannon Paillet, by Wordfire authors. Mm-hmm. So Wordfire is very exciting. We are rapidly growing. We are always looking for talent. We're looking for talent of various kinds. So if any of your listeners here are, for example, developmental editors, we're looking for developmental editors. We'd love to talk to them and about how we kind of compensate those people and what you know, what we need people to do. We are always open to new authors, and that's where I come in. So I am the acquisitions editor, and that means that any book that Wordfire publishes comes through me. So people sometimes who know Kevin or who know Rebecca send the book to Rebecca, and they say, "Oh, I don't know this guy, Dave. Can you look at? Can you publish me? Can I submit?" And they just forward it right to me. So I read the books. And if the book is good enough, then I talk to the author. And because of our model, one of the ways we may differ from a traditional publishing company, although maybe not, right? It depends on the other company. But if you are an author and what your hope is as an author is that you can write a great book and the publisher will take your book out and sell it for you, then you are not a good fit for us. Because we operate like an author's collective, and our authors, including me, perform other roles in the company. We have authors who manage the warehouse, who drive the truck, who stand and sell books, who are also editors or who are proofreaders, who are involved in doing publicity. So step one, your book has to be good enough. And then step two, I have a conversation with you, and we try and figure out, look, what are you going to do if we bring you aboard Wordfire, what would you do to help sell your book? I'm not able to sell it for you. So are you willing to come stand in a booth at a Comic-Con? Are you great at social media? Right? Do you have your own radio show, for example? Mm-hmm. What would you do to sell the book? So that's me. And then I go to Kevin every month or so. And say, I don't even talk about the ones I rejected. I just say, look, here are the three that I want to talk to you about, and we talk them out, and ultimately it's his call, but then he reaches out with a contract.
Wow, what an innovative model, huh?
It's nimble. It's meant to be really nimble and light, mm-hmm. and it's meant to, you know, we want to respond to a changing market. People want stories.
Right.
I believe there is something built into human beings that needs story. And if publishing companies and bookstores are failing to do it, it's not because there's not demand. It's something else, right? It's because they're doing it too expensively, or because they're not bringing out the right stuff.
Well, why don't you share, if you'd like to, share the Wordfire Press website, and then also share where folks can find out more about you and purchase your books.
You bet. And actually, I'm embarrassed to say, I'm not sure whether it's Word. I think it is wordfire.com. I'm 90% sure. I should know that. I'm pretty sure it's wordfire.com. If it's not, it's wordfirepress.com.
Okay.
But if you Google Wordfire Press, you'll find it.
Okay.
And by the way, one thing you'll see is that, frankly, our website is not as up-to-date as it should be. We're moving so fast that one of the pieces we have outgrown is our website, mm-hmm. which is a bit kind of 5 years ago. So they're still catching up to us, but they will. You can find me online, davidjohnbutler.com. I have my social media links, but I tweet it at davidjohnbutler. John has an H. But what I really hope listeners will go look up is The Kidnap Plot. I'm very excited about this book. This is really a book for all readers, and it's available on Amazon right now. Just search for rooftop, a sort of an apocalyptic-looking London. And you can pre-order now, but that's out on June 14th.
Oh, I'm so excited for you, and that is a very cool cover. So yes, everyone head over to Amazon, look for The Kidnap Plot by David John Butler, The Extraordinary Journeys of Clockwork Charlie. This has been a great day for me to meet you and Charlie. Thank you for sharing your time and your books and your process with us. It's just been so enjoyable. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.